Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today, we will spotlight the role of private assets and the role private assets can play in a portfolio, as well as spend time reviewing a performance update and outlook for several types of private assets. Joining us for the conversation today from the UBS Chief Investment Office, glad to welcome our panel. We do have joining us here Jennifer Liu, private market strategist, Leslie Falconio, Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy, John Wallachin, Real Estate and Lodging Analyst, as well as Sean Sanborn, Hedge Fund Strategist. So with that, Jennifer, Leslie, John, and Sean, thank you all for spending some time with our listeners and clients today for a discussion around private assets. I know there's a lot we want to cover with our audience today. To set the table a bit, Jennifer, can you speak a bit to the role private assets can play in a longer-term investment plan? How should investors really be thinking about this? And can you highlight for us some risks as well as opportunities to be mindful of?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. Private assets can serve as a valuable part of a long-term investment portfolio, offering both enhanced returns and diversification benefits. In our analysis, we find that portfolios that include private assets tend to outperform traditional portfolios over the long term. Let's look at some data. Over the past 20 years, if you had a portfolio with 40% global equities, 30% U.S. bonds, and 30% private assets, you would have seen an annualized return of 8% with an 8.8% volatility. Compare that with a traditional 60-40 portfolio, which would have given you a 6.3% return with a higher volatility at 10.5%. Now, investing in private assets has several key benefits. First, expanded universe. There are about 4,000 publicly traded companies in the U.S., but over 10,000 private businesses. Many growing businesses are choosing to stay private longer, which means if you're not investing in private markets, you might miss out on a significant growth phase. Second, the illiquidity premium. While private investments typically lock up your capital for longer periods, you're potentially compensated with higher returns for accepting this illiquidity. Third, a long-term value creation. Private equity ownership models allow for strategic transformation of businesses over multiple years, often leading to operational improvements that public market shareholders can't easily implement. However, there are challenges to consider. First is capital commitment timelines usually range from 7 to 10 years, so private assets might not be a good fit if you need liquidity soon. Performance varies widely between top and bottom quartile managers, making it crucial to choose the right manager. And finally, the J-curve effect means you might see initial negative returns before they turn positive as investments mature. The private investment landscape is evolving to address accessibility concerns. Newer perpetual or evergreen fund structures offer immediate capital deployment, lower minimums, limited period liquidity, and simplified tax reporting. These structures eliminate some operational burdens like capital calls and distributions, while providing exposure comparable to traditional closed-ended funds. For qualified investors with a suitable time horizon, allocating a portion of their portfolio to private assets can enhance a long-term performance while potentially reducing overall portfolio volatility.
Well, Jennifer, that was a very helpful overview of private assets, the role private assets can play in a portfolio, especially from a diversification standpoint. There are several components within that we will cover, including private equity, private credit, real estate, hedge funds. Let's take these in order in terms of a performance update and outlook, beginning with private equity, Jennifer, which is your coverage. What can you share with us there?
Sure, yeah. So in 2024, US PE saw steady improvement, with internal rates of return for the year through Q3 reaching 9.2%. Now, that's up from 7.2% the previous year, and while it's trailing the broader S&P 500, the asset class continues to show its long-term value proposition. The 10-year annualized returns of 15.4% are outperforming the S&P, which is a testament to PE's strength over full market cycles. Now, talking about exit activity, we've seen a substantial recovery through the end of 2024. Exit value rebounded 49% year over year, with corporate acquisitions remaining the dominant exit channel, accounting for 55% of exit value. Even IPO activity is showing modest signs of recovery. However, persistent macroeconomic uncertainties are keeping investors cautious. There's a lot of hesitancy due to policy ambiguity regarding potential tariffs and other issues. In this kind of environment, general partners are laser-focused on operational improvement and preparing companies to exit when the markets stabilize. There's a significant backlog of PE companies waiting to exit, representing approximately 8 years' worth at the current rate. This mounting pressure has led to increased interest in alternative routes, including continuation funds and secondaries. In our most recent report, we looked at how cash flows have behaved across the various asset classes. We found that recent market conditions have altered the traditional J-curve effect, you know, this pattern where you see initial negative returns during the drawdown phase, followed by positive returns as investments mature. This has become steeper for recent vintages in both buyout and venture capital. Particularly for buyout funds, this steepening is most pronounced in the 2020 and 2021 vintages. For investors, it means longer periods before reaching net cash flow break-even. On the flip side, private credit has maintained more consistent cash flow patterns due to its self-liquidating nature and floating rate structure, creating natural distribution events independent of broader market conditions. This highlights the importance of vintage diversification and having realistic liquidity expectations when allocating to private equity, especially for recent fund vintages that may require more patience before delivering meaningful distributions. In the current environment, secondaries are looking quite attractive. They benefit from multiple tailwinds, including more utilization by both LPs and GPs as they search for liquidity, robust fundraising momentum, and a continued expansion of the buyer universe. Secondary market pricing has improved to 89% of NAV across all strategies, with buyout funds achieving the highest pricing at 94 cents on the dollar. And lastly, in the buyout sector, we recommend managers with strong track records in value creation tactics, a focus on growing margins and revenues, and an ability to secure lower entry multiples.
So a lot of considerations there when it comes to private equity. Jennifer, thank you for that. As mentioned, there are, of course, other components that make up private assets, such as private credit. So with that, Leslie Falconio, to welcome you into the conversation, can you provide us with a performance update and outlook on the private credit side?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the performance variables that Jennifer just mentioned, I think it's become very clear, particularly lately, in terms of adding alternatives, and I'm going to speak about private credit, as a means to lowering your volatility. This year, as we've seen, has been very volatile given the uncertainty regarding the new administration, and we've seen volatility in the equity market, we've seen volatility in the public credit markets, but, I think, adding private credit in terms of bringing down overall volatility to your portfolio is key, particularly in an environment such as what we're seeing right now. And on top of that, when we look at sort of how 2024 played out, the direct lending market actually performed very well. It outperformed both, leveraged loans and the high yield market with high single to double digit total returns. And we know that although the market became sort of concerned about the reopening of the capital markets in terms of the public space and what that might mean in terms of competition or lowering underwriting standards, actually what we're seeing now is both the public and the private markets are actually working in tandem. And, one of the things that we're looking at and that's a benefit to the private credit side is the amount of dry powder that remains, on the sidelines. However, as we think about the economy as K-shaped, I mean, we always talk about the U.S. economy and the U.S. consumer as kind of a K-shaped economy. There are, those individuals that are long the equity market that own a home are reaping a lot of benefits. And then on the other side of that, there's those consumers that are struggling a bit, whether it's because of inflation or, having wages not rise. And it's interesting because in the private credit side, you're seeing the same sort of dislocation. That's a lot of tiering and a lot of bifurcation between higher quality loans and those of lower quality loans. And I think that's really been the key in terms of how we've been allocated and how we look at the private credit market. Overall, I mean, the defaults in recently have been between 2.2 and 2.7, which has been, incredibly low. What we call these fixed income, coverage ratios are actually turning a bit more positive as we've had, while the Fed funds rate has remained high, the market is pricing in some cuts, going forward, which could alleviate some of this pressure in terms of interest payments. But overall, the private credit market is held up, incredibly well. But again, there is a lot of tiering. And with that tiering, there's one thing I just want to address because I know it's a big point of conversation and something that we wrote about in the piece that has to do with what we call these pay in kinds, or picks. And this is a big difference in terms of the tiering of the quality of loans. Now, PIK provisions are used for a lot of reasons, right? Growth-oriented borrowers might want to defer interest payments to concentrate on cash flow or growth initiatives, while other borrowers might need to conserve cash, to withstand a difficult period. And when we look at the amount of PIKs that are increasing, it's important to differentiate between what we call a good PIK and a bad PIK. I mean, a lot of the times, there are good PIKs where larger companies actually have picks, you know, originally in the deal, just in terms of this cash flow growth. And then you have sort of a bad pick where you have, you know, companies coming to market simply because they're in a liquidity crunch. They're facing, you know, headwinds in terms of performance. Those are not what we call the good picks, right? But when we look at the overall sort of, you know, pick percentage, most of the picks are coming from actually larger loans. Non-accruals are coming from smaller loans. And that's a really big difference when you think about, you know, future performance. So even though we think the private credit market will continue to do well, obviously, given the changing economy that we're seeing, it's something that we're constantly monitoring. But I could say with right now, defaults continue to remain low. You're still getting double digits in carry. You know, the increased competition from what we've seen right now has not really been a headwind to the private credit market. There's a lot of dry powder on the sidelines. But with that said, where we are in the cycle and where we are in terms of unknown with policies, we would focus on the senior upper middle market sponsor-backed loans. So, right, so we look for the higher quality loans. We are very selective in terms of, you know, the managers that we have, you know, and in terms of being the larger, those managers that have historical total return performance are very key here in terms of how the market will perform, you know, throughout 2025 and 2026, particularly with all the unknowns that we have.
Well, Leslie, thank you for the insights into private credit. Quickly want to promote the publication which Jennifer and Leslie have made reference to thus far, being the quarterly private markets update from the UBS Chief Investment Office. For our clients listening in, please be sure to reach out to your UBS financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy of that piece directly, though within the piece also spent some time covering real estate. So with that, John, can you take a few moments to share some thoughts there?
Yeah, thanks, Dan, and good morning to everybody. After a couple of really tough years in both the public and private real estate space, largely on the back of rapidly rising interest rates, we're starting to see not only a stabilization in rates, but a pickup in transaction activity. And that is not by accident. One of the biggest hindrances to a robust transaction market has not only been the significant increase in rates without the concomitant increase in cap rates, which has put a lot of buyers in what's called a negative leverage position. It's really been the volatility in rates that has kept a lot of people on the sidelines. The other thing that has gone on over the last couple of years is this very wide bid-ask spread between buyers and sellers, with a lot of sellers saying, I want 2021 and 2020 pricing, and that's great. We all want what we can't have, but the realities are that the world shifted when rates moved up precipitously. So one of the keys that we hear from anywhere from the largest private real estate investors to individuals is I can't underwrite if I don't know my cost of capital. There's too many independent variables. So we think the stability in rates is actually almost more important than the level of rates. Now, lower rates, all else being equal, is certainly a positive, but getting more stability in rates will certainly help. And so what we've seen is, and albeit it's early in the process, we are starting to see an increase in transaction activity, which is definitely a positive for private commercial real estate, number one. And number two, we are seeing a narrowing in that bid-ask spread, particularly for those holders of assets that maybe are financially challenged, structurally challenged, and they can't roll over their loans. And so we are certainly much more, no pun intended here, constructive of our outlook for private real estate as we go through 25 into 26 and 27. Now, that is certainly not, you know, broad-based. It's going to be certainly geographically specific, and it's going to be asset class specific. And, certainly we can go into more detail offline with anybody who wants to discuss it, but we think it goes back to, you know, Jennifer's earlier comments about choosing the right manager. If you choose the right manager who has financed properly and is in the right assets at the right basis, and basis does matter, and is in the right geographies, we think on a risk-adjusted return basis, private real estate has a real place in portfolios for clients who can handle the illiquidity, absolutely. Those are some high-level thoughts, Dan.
Thank you, John, for that commentary and guidance covering real estate. As mentioned, we do have Sean Sanborn, hedge fund strategist, joining us as well. So before we close out today, Sean, can you take a few moments to provide our listeners, clients, with a performance update and outlook on hedge funds?
Yeah, of course. Happy to, Dan. Within hedge funds, I wanted to quickly touch on last year to give a better context into how 2025 so far has gone. So we did see equities consistently rally throughout 2024, but still the majority of hedge fund managers were up north of 10%, with the broad HFRI fund-weighted composite index returning 9.8%. And when kind of looking at overall risk exposures or running some form of regression against these returns, a lot of this performance was not due to, call it, increased beta or directional exposures, but rather from a higher orientation towards alpha expressions. Across the hedge fund industry, 2024 was actually one of the best years for alpha production that we've seen in the past two decades. This was led largely by equity long short and relative value, where alpha was considerably strong across the gamut of the majority of the strategies. But there were also select strategies within event-driven, like credit arbitrage and activism, and also discretionary within macro that also posted very healthy alpha levels and outright strong absolute returns. Really, the only strategies that were challenged from a performance perspective within 2024 were systematic macro or kind of managed futures or CTAs and volatility relative value managers that were kind of came in with long convexity exposures that did not necessarily play out as well, consistently trended lower. But to put it blankly, a diversified hedge fund portfolio across the majority of the larger strategies would have vastly outperformed bonds and improved risk-adjusted returns, both a 60-40, but even also an equity-centric portfolio in 2024. Through February of this year, hedge funds in aggregate returned roughly around 1%. While underperforming both equities and bonds, this has largely been due to a weighing down from a exposure to systematic macro and, again, managed futures, as well as directional equity long short strategies that strongly outperformed in 2024. Through February, just quickly on strategies that we've seen strong performance from, this includes equity market neutral, credit arbitrage, discretionary macro, convertible arbitrage, and structured credit, while healthcare long short, large cap TMT, special situations, systematic macro, and again, volatility RV have lagged. So just performance dispersion year to date between more directional and uncorrelated strategies has been relatively wide. Quickly touching on March, while this is kind of only at this point anecdotal evidence, we have heard of some pain within both multi-PM pod equity trading teams, single manager equity long short, and trend following strategies, as there's been some kind of change around just the overall view on a potential recession. And this has largely been around kind of sharp momentum reversals and crowded longs within large cap technology, equities, and long dollar expressions within macro books. Conversely, though, if spreads have modestly widened and macro volatility has picked up, we have seen kind of on the other side of the spectrum discretionary macro, select relative value strategies, and multi-PM shops capitalize on this opportunity by deploying risk to both newer and higher conviction trades and themes. In total, for March, we do expect some hedge fund losses. We do expect overall protection against portfolios with higher allocations to U.S. equities and trailing three-year alpha and as well as one-year alpha returns in aggregate should remain positive. On the risk side, exposures did come down in March and to some extent February. But aggregate risk is still relatively high from a seasonal perspective and continues to trade with a more defensive posture with kind of long-short managers running with larger short books and an underweight to U.S. equities, event-driven managers moving towards hard catalyst trades with higher probabilities of close and more correlations to equity markets, such as vertical M&A deals and debt restructurings. Macro managers are biased to be short equities, long the dollar, although this positioning has somewhat moderated in March. Long gold, long U.S. deepeners, and short European rates, while lastly, relative value managers have been taking profits, have spreads of reach tights, and are waiting to capitalize on any dislocations, which we did see to some extent in mid-March. In sum, we still see lower exposures to beta and duration, and instead managers have been preferred trade, have had a preference to trade relative value, pair, or uncorrelated trades. And as kind of everyone here has echoed so far, there's just been multiple factors that should create dislocations and higher floors for volatility. This includes both fiscal and monetary policies across regions should continue to diverge. Chair rhetoric has turned in implementation. Globalization trends continue to reverse. Geopolitical tensions remain at inflection points. and equity valuations are still hovering near the top quartile. So overall dispersion both within and across markets should continue to increase, and again, volatility should continue to reach a higher overall floor. This creates ample opportunity for the bevy of hedge funds to lean into alpha-oriented exposures and provide uncorrelated return streams to investor portfolios. At the moment, we still continue to favor less directional and overall arbitrage-oriented strategies across the hedge fund landscape. On the diversifier side, this includes discretionary macro, which can quickly shift risks and is historically capitalized on higher macroeconomic fall, and equity market neutral, which tends to isolate alpha opportunities and has historically outperformed during periods of higher equity dispersion and long short spreads that we see today. Finally, on the arbitrage side, we favor fixed income relative value, which still holds higher cash balances and should be able to exploit any short-term kinks across basis, yield curve relative value, and swap spread trades as rate volatility stays elevated and there's higher debt issuance across sovereign banks that gets flooded into the market. Convertible arbitrage, which still benefits from higher issuance and equity volatility, and lower net fundamental credit or credit arbitrage that can still extract carry but also can take higher quality risks as fundamentals and defaults remain stable. On the arbitrage side, just quickly, we do express some caution on these strategies as spreads do remain historically tight even after a modest widening in March. This includes kind of the U.S. catch up futures basis trade and large cap convertibles within kind of the tech sector. That do still remain crowded, but in all, we still do view the opportunity set in a bullish light.
Well, Sean, thank you for the insights there into hedge funds. So as we begin to wrap up, you, our listener, as you've heard today from Jennifer, Leslie, John, and Sean, quite a few considerations, avenues when thinking about incorporating private assets into one's portfolio, accounting for private equity, private credit, real estate, and hedge funds. And for you, our listener, we do, of course, encourage you to have a follow-up conversation with your UBS financial advisor to learn more about these types of asset classes. Before we close out, Sean, any final thoughts or takeaways you would like to leave us with?
For recent research pieces on the hedge fund side, we have, in the past week or so, published content on comprehensive performance and positioning across the entire hedge fund landscape for February, as well as a piece on how hedge fund strategies should perform in uncertain times that we see today.
Thank you, Sean, for highlighting those resources, and do look forward to having follow-up conversations. Again, I do want to point out to our listeners and our clients, we have as well been making reference to today to the quarterly private markets update from the UBS Chief Investment Office. Again, for clients of UBS, please reach out to your UBS financial advisor if you would like to receive a copy directly. Though again, from the UBS Chief Investment Office, we've been joined today by Jennifer Liu, Leslie Falconio, John Wallace, and Sean Sanborn. Jennifer, Leslie, John, Sean, thank you again for spending some time with our listeners and clients today. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure, Dan.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
Investing in an alternative investment fund is speculative and involves significant risks. For a discussion on these risks, please visit ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer-NTA.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.